Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for the spring breaking Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, and we are using that term extremely loosely today, a bad and crazy martinis for conservatives. And Ian, it's your colleague, Jonah Goldberg, and his column that's the subject of our quote-unquote good martini today. It's in the Los Angeles Times, and it starts out by saying, nominating Donald Trump will wreck the Republican Party as we know it. Not nominating Donald Trump will wreck the Republican Party as we know it. The sooner everyone recognizes this fact, the better. Denial has been Trump's greatest ally. Republicans and commentators didn't believe he would run. They didn't believe he could be an attractive candidate to rational people, no matter how angry with the establishment voters said they were. They, which includes me, were wrong. He says there's a number of scenarios here to stop Trump from being the nominee that could potentially avoid a calamitous result for the Republican Party. One is for Cruz to win the nomination outright, which seems increasingly unlikely given what happened in Arizona yesterday and the map ahead. Second, he says Trump could reveal he has a hidden reserve of magnanimity and patriotism and rally his faithful to the consensus nominee. Stop laughing. And third, the delegates could pick someone sufficiently attractive that Trump followers get over their understandable bitterness and support that candidate despite Trump's objections. And obviously, that's extraordinarily unlikely. So basically, the implosion of the Republican Party is coming no matter what happens. And now it's just a determination of which side of the implosion folks need to line up on. So when we're sifting through the ruins, it can be rebuilt properly. Is that what we're looking at?
So this is our good martini, remember?
Yes.
We're truly eking out a silver lining here. You know, there's certainly something to what Jonah is saying. The simple fact that we're working in massive amounts of people here, I think, militates in favor of the scenario he's laid out. You know, if we were working in smaller groups where you could sort of trust or put some hope in the character of individuals to, you know, set aside egos and the rest, then there might be a little more reason for optimism. But we're working in, you know, huge crowds, and so you're likely to be looking at the lowest impulses at work throughout this whole process. So, yeah, I think there is something to that, which is why I think Jeb's decision to endorse Cruz and Lindsey Graham as well is a good thing. You know, there are people out there who will posit that this plays badly for Cruz, that, you know, he doesn't want this establishment imprimatur, you know, all the rest. I think we're long past that. If you take a thesis like Jonah's seriously, which I do, we're long past the point where we're quibbling over, you know, tactics about, you know, like Scott Walker's talking about, I want the timing to be right. We're way past timing here, Scott. We're at a point where the remaining question is which Republicans have an inclination left over of something called honor, and which don't, which are going to sell out or keep silent. You know, Chris Christie is, of course, on the other side of this. And so I think for Jeb and for Lindsey Graham and hopefully for others who will come out of the woodwork, the point is to plant their flag in favor of the Republican Party as the institution that we've known that with all of its flaws is a good one. William Rusher, the late publisher of National Review, said that the Republican Party is a vessel for conservatism, like a bottle is a vessel for wine. That's true. That gives a rationale for saying, you know, if the Republican Party fails, we'll find a new vessel. And I think that there are a lot of people who are open to that. But the flip side of that is that the Republican Party, like any institution, builds up organic customs and a sort of institutional culture that takes time to develop. If the Republican Party were to dissolve, whatever crops up won't be the party of Lincoln and the party of Eisenhower and the party of Reagan. It'll be something new that can sort of claim that mantle, maybe intellectually, but it won't be institutionally the same thing. And that matters. The question of the survival of the Republican Party as an institution is a very important one, and one that people can defend in an intellectually honest way, which is what I think Jeb and Lindsey and this crowd are doing. if everything goes down in flames, it'll be good. It will be a good thing that we can look back and say, this person and this person and this person staked their claim in a showed their support for a venerable institution. And it'll be good that we can say this person and this person and this person didn't. I think that'll be instructive.
Well, the other good news, it's kind of like a hurricane. Jonah's basically the weather forecaster saying there's going to be a calamity here. And if there's going to be a calamity, you'd like some advance notice and not just have it show up one day completely unannounced and not be ready for it in any sort of way.
Certainly.
So Hurricane Cleveland is coming. And one way or another, we need to batten down the hatches. And I guess knowing a couple months ahead of time is better than not knowing at all. So thanks, Jonah, for that riveting and really uplifting good martini today. Ian, you talked a lot about the higher ideals right there, the party, and trying to lift up the virtues and the values and the principles of from which conservatism rises and is rooted in our country. And then there's our bad martini today. There's no good actors here. Everybody deserves to be scolded roundly. There's a new super PAC out there called Make America Awesome, which, if you haven't heard the Trump slogan, is obviously a takeoff of his Make America Great Again. This group is not at all in favor of Donald Trump. The super PAC exists to stop him from being the nominee. It is headed up by a woman named Liz Mayer. We talked about her months and months ago in the Three Martini Lunch when she was let go by the Scott Walker campaign, which tells you how long ago that was, after she had some disparaging things to say about Iowans on Twitter. She and this group put out an ad aimed specifically at Utah, I believe, that featured a picture of Melania Trump before she was Mrs. Trump from a GQ nude photo shoot from, I think, about the turn of the century, right about 2000, somewhere in there, with the caption essentially saying, "Is this who you want to be your next first lady?" Obviously, that is deplorable. There's a lot of reasons not to want Donald Trump to be president. If you're going to make that argument, make a substantive argument about why he shouldn't be president. There's certainly ammunition out there for that cause. So this is a really cheap shot at Donald and Melania Trump. But then Trump responds in a way that only Trump can by completely ignoring the facts. He says, "Lion Ted Cruz," this is on Twitter, of course, "Lion Ted Cruz just used a picture of Melania from a GQ shoot in his ad. Be careful, Lion Ted, or I will spill the beans on your wife." So not only is this photo not from the Cruz campaign, it's not from the Cruz super PAC, which is not allowed to have contact with the campaign anyway, it's with a completely separate super PAC. Then he goes on to say, because the Cruz campaign obviously pointed out that it had nothing to do with this ad, "Lion Ted Cruz denied he had anything to do with the GQ model photo post of Melania. That's why we call him Lion Ted." So Trump obviously is either clueless on the system and just wants to blame Cruz because he's the only rival left for the Republican nomination, effectively, or he really has no idea what the rules are on super PACs. Ian, so a lot of condemnations to spread around here. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing's just low and lousy. I mean, it was a lousy ad. It didn't need to play. You know, they played it in Utah because you've got arguably the most Republican state in the country, you know, heavily Mormon, et cetera. You know, but there was no reason. There was no reason to do that. And despite the fact that Donald Trump has numerous associates, numerous business projects, you know, et cetera, in his constellation that are all fair game. But Melania's pretty much been on the outside of this. She's, you know, played the good trooper for him. And it was a lousy ad that didn't really serve any purpose. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't effective, and it was rather ugly. But we're in a cycle where Donald Trump can take that ugliness and somehow manage to double down on it and make it worse, which is exactly what he did with the tweet, or the first tweet that he sent out. He deleted. And people thought, you know, well, maybe he realized he made an error. And then he reposted it. And the only difference was that in the original tweet, he just said Ted instead of Lion Ted. You know, but he wanted to get Lion Ted in there. So he just doubled down on his absolute, his utter falsehood. But of course, the most disgusting part of this is the threat against Heidi Cruz that he's going to, quote, spill the beans. He did this against Marco Rubio's wife at one point. Trump doesn't have anything on any of these people. There's nothing to have on any of these people. But this is what Trump does, which he works in the realm of vague conspiratorial insinuations. There's this whole fringe of Twitter people who are now going to be, you know, rubbing their Cheeto-covered hands together, thinking that there's some great bombshell to out there about Heidi Cruz. That's just another reason why, you know, Ted Cruz is pro-Canadian, you know, pro-Canadian fifth columnist who can't be president. I mean, this is just the utter fantasy world in which many Trump people live and that Trump eggs on. It's disgusting, and it lowers, if that's possible, it lowers even further the bar for reasonable and respectful political discourse. So, you know, a lousy ad in Utah, and Donald Trump has gone and made this so much worse. And it's something that we'll continue to hear about because it's going to become part of sort of the mythology that Donald Trump has created over the course of his campaign.
Well, you know what the crushing scandal of Jeanette Rubio was? The New York Times exposed that months ago, that she's racked up a few speeding tickets over the last 20 years.
That's right. Man,
horrific.
She's, yeah.
But let's move on from the salacious, tawdry stuff from the bad martini and move on to more substantive material for the crazy martini here. This is courtesy of USA Today. Never far from a glowing screen, Sarah Palin may be coming to a TV dial near you. She will star in a new Judge Judy-style courtroom reality show in 2017, according to a publicist for a Montana production company. The former governor of Alaska, who's already starred in her own reality show since the end of her vice presidential campaign in 2008, signed a production deal last month with a Montana-based company called Warm Springs, according to Howard Bragman of 15 Minutes PR. Palin's show, still unnamed, would feature Palin in a nationally syndicated daytime show premiering in the fall of 2017. But first, she has to make a pilot, meet with TV stations across the land, and sell it and herself to them, which shouldn't be too difficult, even though Palin is not a lawyer. Quote, she's sold millions of books, one of which sold over 2 million copies. She's a proven ratings draw because she's had a couple other reality shows like Sarah Palin's Alaska and Amazing America with Sarah Palin. So, law degree notwithstanding on this stuff. Ian, what do you make of Sarah Palin jumping into the daytime TV realm?
This is so perfect. This is so perfect. I should say, I find it almost painful to talk about Sarah Palin because I remember vividly in 2008, people I talked to who could not stand John McCain or were completely anesthetized by his presence, who became excited when he selected Sarah Palin.
Yes.
And, you know, the only reason John McCain only lost to Barack Obama, the historic messianic Democratic candidate, was by 6 points. The only reason he lost by 6 points was because of Sarah Palin. But we are now so far from the Sarah Palin of 2008, who had missteps along the campaign trail, but wasn't embarrassing. Now she's embarrassing. I find this painful to say because I know there are so many people out there who had such a connection to Sarah Palin. This news that she's going to be doing this daytime show is such a perfect encapsulation of what has happened to the Republican Party and the rise of the entertainment wing of the party. I mean, think about it. We have the front runner of the Republican race is a reality TV star who will potentially turn in to the holder of high elected office, whose primary endorser is a woman who had high executive office and is turning into a reality television star. I mean, the symmetry there is utterly amazing. It's so revealing about the priorities of just a massive number of people on the right who have been sucked into a vision of a superficial version of conservatism that has nothing to do with principles or ideas or substantive policy, but that is all marketing, all advertisement, all, you know, exactly what Donald Trump says, winning. And the winning here is polls and ratings. And those two, Donald Trump and Sarah Palin, are sort of the perfect encapsulation of the fact that the conflation in our political society now of polls and ballots and Nielsen ratings. It's just, you couldn't write this. You couldn't write this better.
I remember 10, 15, maybe longer years ago, Ian, where the general consensus whenever a celebrity spoke up for a liberal cause on the right was, we don't care what you say. You're not an expert on this. Go back to your movies. Go back to your singing. And then once a few conservative-leaning celebrities started to pop up, all of a sudden, we really, really liked them. And it came to a head, I think, most of all, in the California recall in 2003 when Gray Davis was on his way out. And Arnold Schwarzenegger threw his hat into the ring, and there was a rock-ribbed conservative in the race who's now in Congress. He was a state senator in California at the time named Tom McClintock, who would have been a fabulous governor. And Arnold Schwarzenegger easily won with no political experience whatsoever, other than, I think, leading the first President Bush's Council on Physical Fitness. Landslide win there. Tried to do a few conservative things. Didn't work in California and pretty much ran as a liberal for re-election in 2006. And I think that was perhaps the dawn of the celebrity culture on the right.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the other part of it is conservatives have been so desperate for celebrities. We've longed for celebrities. It's just taken as a given that if you're prominent in Hollywood or in New York media culture, you're going to be liberal. So every time we find one of these people, we cling to them desperately. Ted Nugent is on the board of the NRA despite posting a couple weeks back just a heinous anti-Semitic, post on Facebook, and all these people rush to his defense. We have the folks from Duck Dynasty who are now surrogates for presidential candidates. I mean, and that includes Ted Cruz. I mean, we've abandoned the desire and the need to have substantive people making substantive arguments because we've been so desperate to have someone who has a Hollywood star on our side, and we've become utterly starstruck to our detriment.
Again, leaving on a high note, Ian. Good to have you with us as always. Talk to you tomorrow.
Sounds good, Greg. Thanks.
Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.